Hi, this is Marsha Altman. I'm the author of The Darcys and the Bingleys, and I'm here to talk about my fourth book, which is called The Ballad of Gregoire Darcy. If you haven't read the previous three books, then I recommend you go read them, or at least catch up on the podcasts. The books in order are Book One, The Darcys and the Bingleys, Book Two, The Plight of the Darcy Brothers, Book Three, Mr. Darcy's Great Escape, and then Book Four, which was published in May, which is The Ballad of Gregoire Darcy. If you're not familiar with these podcasts, I'm going to spend part one talking about the book in a non-spoilery sense. For people who haven't read the book or just don't want things given away, and then in the second half, I'll talk more technically about plot lines that people have already read about. So, anyway, part one. If you're again new to this series, you somehow wound up starting with book four. This was the first book that I put in an introduction where I summarized the first three books, mostly because some fans were, it was particularly my mom, and I was getting some comments from my mom who, provides feedback when she actually sees the book that she couldn't remember every single plot line, and since there was a year or more between when she had read books, and she doesn't really have time to reread them right before she reads the new one, that I should summarize what happened in the other books, which I did, and I also provided a family tree, which was requested by many people because the family is now grown and some people have died, and it's important to remember who everybody is. And of course, the family tree is pretty much only going to get bigger at this point. Some people will die off, but over the course of the series, there'll be more people. So there's an introduction to family tree. A lot of reviewers who were new to the series with this book found that helpful. And there's also a bibliography of research that I did to kind of prove that I did do research, because I really did do research for this book. Not to say I didn't do research for the other books, but this was, I think this is the first book that has like a full bibliography of not everything I've ever read, but everything I read immediately pertaining to this book. When I was doing revision, I did a lot of research to make sure that things I had done were reasonably correct. So I'm assuming now at this point you've read the first three books, and I can just go ahead and assume certain knowledge, which is that the first one being that this is a book about Gregoire Darcy, which I'm not actually pronouncing correctly. It's a French name. He's the half, he's the bastard half brother of Darcy, and he his father was Mr. Darcy's father, Geoffrey Darcy, who's been dead since the before the series started, before Pride and Prejudice, he was already dead. And Lady Anne, who is Darcy's mother's lady maid, her personal maid is was Gregoire's mother. And he was born in France. The maid was sent away after she found out she was pregnant, and she went back to her native France. He was raised there, and Darcy discovered his existence in the second book. And he's been living in different monasteries his whole life, and this book is about his journey to kind of find himself after he has to leave his monastery for reasons that, because they're spoilers, I won't go into right now. But most of the book he spends trying to kind of find his feet in not s specifically English society. He was never going to fit into English society. But just any society, anywhere where he would fit in with his understanding of the universe and all that, which is very different from Darcy, not just because Darcy is Protestant and he's Catholic, but because he has really lived a life totally outside of the world that Darcy lives in. And, they get along very, very well, but they really have very few points of contact other than the fact that they're brothers. And Darcy obviously has to support him without undermining Gregoire's very medieval view of the universe. So that's really what this book is about. After book three, which encompassed just a tremendous amount of story and plot lines for different characters, I really wanted to focus more on do a smaller thing. The book is shorter than book three. Most books are shorter than book three. It's more, I think it's down to the length of book two. There's very few, in my from my perspective, there's very few subplots, though there are a bunch because things are going on. Mary Bennett, who's now a single mother living in her father's house at Longbourn, she gets a subplot which, involves some romance for her. Dr. Maddox has kind of an ongoing plot with his relationship with the Prince Regent, who is now officially no longer the Prince of Wales. He's now the Prince Regent. His father is officially mad. His father is still King George III, but the book takes place in 1817, and King George III dies in 1820, and the Prince Regent then becomes King George IV, who will reign for 10 years and then die in 1830. And of course, Dr. Maddox not only works for the king, but has some background information in his relationship with the prince and his family that comes up from time to time. But at this point, Dr. Maddox has had two children with Caroline, as well as his adopted son. He's not going to have any more. I eventually had to just make the wives stop having children because they were getting to be too many children for me to be able to possibly deal with within the scope of the books. Plus, not a lot of kids lived past childbirth. A lot of women died in childbirth too, and I didn't want that to happen. So everyone has like three or four kids, pretty much. Bingleys have four, the Darcys have four, and Dr. Maddox and Caroline have three. I don't actually ever say how many Kitty has. Anyway, so there's some Dr. Maddox. Mugen, who is the Japanese ex-convict who hangs around with Brian when he does trade with the Orient, is in this book. He has a brief appearance. This is the last time we're going to see Mugen until book eight, when it becomes a major, major plot point as to where Mugen has been. I mean, he goes back to Japan. It's not really a huge mystery as to where he goes because he's Japanese and he lives in Japan for, almost his entire life. But sort of he leaves in a huff, and we're not going to see him again for a while. And then when we do, it'll be really, really important. But that was a track that I kind of wanted to lay down. I realized it was going to happen, that plot line between him and Georgiana Bingley. Started that in book three, didn't know where it was going to go. This is the book where I realized it was going to be major eventually, which it is in many ways, even though Mugen is off camera for several books. And then it kind of comes to a climax in book eight. So there's that. And I also did a short story of him that takes place during the book in my collection of short stories, Other Tales, which you can get for free on my website. And what else is going on in this book? Oh, and this is a transitional book. It's not a major transitional book where their whole world turns upside down like book three, but this is the first book where it's not the first book where you can see the children's characters emerging, but they're becoming more and more hardened as characters. And for example, George Wickham, the younger, because George Wickham the older is dead, is now, I believe he turns 13 in this book. And to give some perspective, you could go to university as early as 14 in Georgian England. Jane Austen's, at least one of Jane Austen's brothers went to university at 14. I believe it was her oldest brother went at 14. And her father possibly went at 14. I know that a bunch of people in her family went at 14. George does not go to university that early. But the whole idea of going to a boarding school like Eton or Harrow, which Geoffrey Darcy goes to, is kind of a rich people's aristocratic thing. It cost a lot of money, and it was basically just an exaggerated sleepaway camp with Latin for a few years before you went to university, which was also that. Very few people were serious scholars. There were opportunities for serious scholars, but there was also a lot of opportunities for just hanging out for a couple of years. And we see that George has kind of grown up enough to realize the world that he's in and what's going to be expected of him, how he's really going to have to take care of his sister. Not that anything's wrong with her, but his mother has remarried since his father's death, and she has all these kids with her new husband. And George and Lydia Wickham have to kind of fend for themselves so that they have Darcy there for them, and they have money as a result of Darcy killing their dad, basically. But George is moving into adulthood, and the rest of the kids aren't very far behind. Both Geoffrey Darcy, the oldest of the Darcy children, and Georgiana Bingley, the oldest of the Bingley children, are like 12. So they know that their time is coming, and they're aware that there are expectations that, are going to come up very soon, even though neither of them are in society properly. But they will be in the next book. This book takes place, it's the last book where they're not in society. The next book will be the one where they enter society and also kind of enter the main plot line and become instruments through which the plot occurs instead of just sort of side characters who are still developing. One of the things I'm more proud of in this entire series is how the cast moves from the central couples of the first five books to the central couples of books 6 through 10. How the generation kind of flows into the next one and the new challenges that the new generation has to meet, which are different from the old generation, but there's some continuity there. There's still the basics of we have to get married and have kids and blah, 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 blah. So this is the first book where you have a serious plot line involving one of the kids, which is George, though it's somewhat resolved. It's not a major plot line. It will come up again. And just some more things for people who are new to this book. I have a different publisher. It's Ulysses Press. So if you are the only person in the universe who buys books directly from the publisher on their website, and you were looking at source books trying to find my fourth book, you won't find it there. You'll find it everywhere else, but you won't find it at the Sourcebooks website. And the book, it looks a little different. There's a slightly different scheme to the cover. We tried to do some continuity, and then we had to do some different things to avoid some legal issues with the old publisher. You can't make things to look too similar. The book is taller and less wide. It has a different size to it. I don't think this detracts or adds to the book. I think it's the reading experience is basically the same, but these are not decisions I make. The publisher just prints whatever size book they want to do, and Sourcebooks likes to do shorter, fatter books, and Ulysses Press likes to do taller books. So if you line them up on the shelves, it'll be slightly taller and it won't go as deeply into the shelf. I'll talk more in the second half about the editorial challenges of this book, which were not nearly as bad as book three, but there were some. And a last note on the cover, I should really do a podcast just about the cover, because not this cover, but all of the covers, because there is like a huge world of covers in Pride and Prejudice, but Gregoire is not on the cover. Gregoire is a monk, and even when he's not a monk, he doesn't dress like a normal Englishman, because he's not. He's a French monk. We really didn't know what to do with that because the cover has to communicate that this is a Regency period book. And there's not a lot of Regency period portraits of monks. And I came up with one, and it was a monk, and they said, no, we really want Darcy to be on the cover somehow. So they came up with this picture, which looks like it's two brothers, and one of them could easily be Darcy. And it was a hunting scene, and I just said, fine, even though neither of them represent Gregoire, this was really the best we were going to do, and I think it's a really good job. So I'm pretty happy with the cover. But no, you're not going to see Gregoire on the cover just because people's heads are not going to go to Regency period. If they see a monk, they're going to go to the medieval period, and we didn't want anyone to get confused about the cover. So that's it. I think that's all I have to say that's not full of spoilers. So I hope that you read the book, enjoy the book. Also, go to my website to pick up other tales, other stories from The Ballad of Gregoire Darcy, which is three stories that are related to this book in particular, but also the series in general. I'll do a separate podcast on that, I guess. And also, it's available for 99 cents on Amazon if you have a Kindle, because I can't get Amazon to sell it any lower. So you can get them for free on my website and on a bunch of different other websites. If you want to read more about the stories in this book beyond the book itself, just things that didn't make it in, There's an ebook for you. It's very short. It's worth, what you're getting. You're getting it for free. So anyway, I'm gonna move on now. Part two. This is for people who've read the book. And I don't really have a tremendous amount to say about this book that I didn't cover in the first part, in comparison to obviously to book three. What happened with the publisher is that, look, I can't really go into detail because I have a good relationship with Sourcebooks. But in short, I can understand that they didn't really tell me why. They just said, no, we don't want the fourth book. I suspect they didn't read it. It was usually the whether they buy the next book is either based on sales or based on your relationship with them. And book three was difficult for both of us, so they probably thought, we don't want to go through this in every book. We don't know what this author's going to do. She's not a very predictable author. And it's true. I mean, there are books in this series that are not the same as previous books. There are kind of ordinary books where things are just happening. And then there's one book that's almost entirely in Japan. There's one book that's a murder mystery. I do kind of go off the rails occasionally. So I was orphaned by Sourcebooks. They didn't pick up the fourth book. They keep the rights to the first three and they sell the first three and they're totally responsible for those. I'm very happy with the job they've been doing on the first three books. And my agent and I took it to other publishers, and Ulysses Press, which has been mainly responsible for publishing Regina Jeffers, who was originally self-published, decided to pick it up, along with hiring me to do The Road to Pemberley, which is an anthology of Pride and Prejudice fan fiction, which they hired me basically at the same time that they bought this book to put together the anthology, which I did. It includes one story of mine, which is like a page long and has nothing to do with this series. But if you're interested in anthologies, I did a video about it, which is basically a podcast, but you can see me. So you can check that out. I think it's linked on my website. It's definitely linked on my website, but if you search Road to Pemberley video, then you will get me talking about the Road to Pemberley. But that happened at the same time, and it was a different set of editors. Everyone's doing a competent job, but there is a essential difference. Sometimes editors are more experienced in the Regency period and know things that are odd in the text to people who don't know the Regency period. For example, the word town, if it's capitalized, means the West End of London. It refers to the part of London that rich people live in. So if someone says, I'm going to town, and there's a capital T, the indicator means I'm going to the West End of London where rich people live. And if it's a lowercase t, it just means an ordinary town, which London was not a town, it was a city. So over various books, I've had editors, depending on their level of familiarity with Regency period, decapitalize my use of the word town, and then I had to recapitalize it, and they would go decapitalize it again, and then I would, come back to me and I would say, no, look, when I say town, I am very specifically mean one thing or another, depending on whether the T is capitalized or not. So please stop correcting it. Where it's correct is where I know in my head it's correct. And there are a lot of issues involving Vatican politics and Catholicism at this time period, which is a very difficult time period to write about the experience of a monk, because you have two basic time periods. One being the Middle Ages, which is the great age of Western monasticism, which ended with the Counter-Reformation, mostly because the Reformation caused a lot of areas that had had a lot of monks to be Protestant and have no more monasteries. All the monasteries were dissolved by King Henry VIII in both England, Ireland, and Scotland. That shouldn't be a both, that should be an end. But so even a heavily Catholic country like Ireland had no monasteries beyond the 16th century. But the monasteries stayed open in Catholic countries until this period. It started with the French Revolution, and all the monasteries in France were dissolved during the French Revolution, and then Napoleon continued that when he conquered a lot of Western Europe. The monasteries originally, in the original version of the book, Gregoire is in a German monastery, and then I found out that in book three, when he's in a German monastery, there were no German monasteries. They had been dissolved a few years before, so I moved him to Austria because some monasteries in Austria missed, they didn't, Napoleon didn't enforce that there, and they stayed open. Once you go beyond Austria, if you're just going east, you're going to hit Russia, which is Orthodox Christian, which is very different from Catholic, so there's not a lot of options there for a Catholic. And I had to send him to Spain, which did dissolve a lot of its monasteries, not just because of Napoleon, but also because of internal revolutions based on the Enlightenment. A lot of people wanted to get rid of the old order of aristocrats and kings, and part of the old order was the church. So a lot of monasteries were dissolved. Not all of them were. And Italy was really the only place that was untouched during this period, pretty much, because it was Italy. The Papal States, controlled by the Pope at various points, they weren't, but Italy really was the only place that was unaffected. Not unaffected, but its monasteries were not dissolved. And I had to do a lot of research to figure out exactly where I was going to place him, and I made up a fake monastery and a fake archbishopric. There were only five archbishoprics in all of Spain at this time period, of which I'm sure there are more now. So if you're ever reading about monasteries in Europe that are currently open and they're in Western Europe, chances are they are not the originals, or if they're housed in the originals, then they took like an 80-year break from being a monastery because and then they were reestablished. In fact, there's monasteries in England now that have been reestablished after like 500 years of there not being any monasteries in England. And they're generally very, very small. The age of European monasticism is over. So anyway, the editor that I was working with was familiar with medieval Christianity, which is different from the Christianity of the 19th century. And then she was actually a Catholic. She is a Catholic. I'm not. She's a post, she's your average, somewhat well-versed post-Vatican II Catholic, and Vatican II did a lot to change monastic culture. So there were a lot of issues that we went back and forth on of could this have happened? Who would be the correct person, the archbishop or the bishop or whatever, or and there were a lot of cases where I said, well, I can't find information either way, so we're going to have to go with it because it's like a major plot point. I mean, the major plot point was, would Gregoire really have hid his money from the abbot? Because the rule of Saint Benedict says that you can't have your own items, you have to give them up. And the answer is, well, he should have, but he didn't. Like, he broke the rule. That's why he gets kicked out. He gets kicked out for kind of a number of complicated political reasons, but which in some ways were very true to life in the way that I've understood them. I always leaned a little more medieval than modern because it's just easier to do that. But there wasn't a lot of material on monastic life at this exact time period because most of the books about European monasticism at this time period are more concerned with monasteries being dissolved than what was going on in them. Did find some source material that was very good, and I told her that, if someone corrects me, I will be very happy for them to tell me where they found their information because I have exhausted my English sources as far as, what I could get in time while I was editing this, because sometimes you get very little time between edits when you're going back and forth with the editor and you have to go over every page, and sometimes you get like 2 days to do it. And then you hit like a major point where you're going back and forth and you're saying, well, I'm not sure this could have happened, but we can't change it at this point. It's too connected to the plot. So there was a lot of that in the basically all of the scenes that involve Catholic politics. There was some back and forth as to, how realistic is this? And so I got away with a lot because I made up characters. I didn't make up the Pope, but I did make up the Pope's brother, who's the abbot. He's not a real person. I had to change some things about the Pope, not about my discussion about his life when they mentioned him, because it's not really clear how he wasn't, exactly what was popular about what he was writing, blah, blah, blah. There's a lot of internal things that are very obscure to Catholic history that, originally when I wrote this book, I was relying a lot on Wikipedia, which you shouldn't do. So I had to correct some things. Very, very minor. What else did I correct? There's a couple lines that got dropped from this book. I have a friend who I met, a very big fan, and she was such a big fan that she had read the series many times over in its fanfiction.net form. And she said, well, why would I noticed that there was a paragraph missing from the abbot's letter to Gregoire. What's up with that? And I was like, well, we couldn't really decide how historical it was, so we just cut it. At that point, you know, this is a pick your battle sort of situation. There were some scenes that like end on a funny note, and the editor felt that that detracted from the seriousness of the scene. I didn't want to fight it. I just said I have to, other issues that I'm going to stand up for. I don't care one way or another whether this particular line makes it into the series. I just can't care about every single line all of the time. I'm so exhausted about caring about everything else that every once in a while some issue comes up and I'm like, reason to fight this is so minimal, and the editor might actually be right. So I'm just going to let the editor make the decision here and okay it because, you know, they're an editor, they're a professional. They know what they're doing most of the time, if not all of the time. Other issues with this book that I now realize was a mistake. Originally, Gregory Darcy, who is Darcy and Gregor's crazy uncle, who was introduced in the previous book via Darcy talking about it and was reintroduced in this book in the form of them reading his journals and taking his body back to Pemberley, sort of reestablishing him as a person who was important to the family history but was written out for a very specific reason. He was originally diagnosed with monomania, which was a term that they sort of a catch-all for, we don't have psychiatric terms, so we're calling it monomania, though technically it means that you are hyper-focused on one thing. That's the actual definition of monomania, which isn't a term that is used for diagnosis anymore, but it does have a real terminology. At the time, monomania is what they called things that were serious but they didn't have names for. And I had an editor who felt, because there were a number of different people who worked on this book, and I had an editor who felt that it really should have called hysteria instead of monomania. And my source material, I have a lot of source material on the history of psychiatry, sort of indicated both. Like there were some books that said it should be called hysteria, and there were some books that said it should be called monomania, and I couldn't tell one way or the other legitimately what term I should use. So I decided to go with the editor's choice of hysteria. And then I was talking to my roommate, I think it was a week ago, and she said, well, hysteria is related to women's issues. Women are more called hysterical more often than men. Hysteria refers to women who are, you know, insane. It's a women's issue thing. It has the HY as sort of an indicator of that. I don't know of a guy who's ever been called hysteric. Now, I know that in history, guys have been diagnosed with hysteria, but probably monomania was a better way to go. I'd be really interested to know if, you know, to get in the opinion of some historian as to which way it would have been better, though it doesn't really matter now. It's actually pretty much a throwaway line, and it can't be changed. But it's an interesting discussion in terms of the history of psychiatry, you know, in the prehistory that psychiatry exists at this time period, you know, what was the correct, what they would have correctly diagnosed him with. Even though they weren't giving a correct diagnosis, what diagnosis would they actually have given him? So if anyone knows whether it would have been hysteria or monomania, just let me know because I'm interested. I want to know the answer to the question. Other things that came up, Gregory, when he's buried, he's buried outside of the graveyard plot. They actually pull out the fence and so that he's buried within the graveyard, but he's not buried on sacred land because consecrated ground, because he was a suicide. There's some issue with the word suicide. In Regency of England, they use the term self-murder to refer to something that someone did. But whether someone was a self-murder, that didn't sound correct to me. And they did have the word suicide, they just didn't use it. But when referring to him as what his status was as a dead person, it was a suicide, not a self-murder. What he committed was self-murder. But, and so he couldn't be buried in the graveyard. Though I'm not 100% sure that Protestants would have really put up anything about putting him in the graveyard, but since Gregoire was really the one who said, let's bring him back, and Gregoire was Catholic and definitely would have had a problem with it, then I decided to put him on in the graveyard, but not really in the graveyard. Also, a lot of people think that Pemberley is based on Chatsworth, which is in Derbyshire, and there's good reason to think that. But when I was at Chatsworth, which, you know, is not a replica of Pemberley, it's actually far too big for someone of Mr. Darcy's income to have kept up. You have to be much richer than he was. The actual guy who owned Chatsworth made 200,000 a year, whereas Darcy made 10,000. So there are no graveyards except for pets. There are various pets that are buried in these massive stone monuments or tombstones that are the size of people. And, occasionally when I was walking the grounds, I would hit a tombstone and it would be for a cat. It turns out that, the actual Duke of Devonshire is buried elsewhere, and usually people were buried in a church cemetery, not in a private cemetery, depending on family custom. But in the Darcy family, which is a fake family made up by Jane Austen, they have their own graveyard. A lot of things have happened at that graveyard. Wickham is in that graveyard. I think Wickham died in the graveyard itself. And now Gregory is in the graveyard, and Saint Sebaldus is also in the graveyard. So it's a very interesting graveyard. I totally forgot to mention this in my discussion of book three, but one of the things that was just outright cut from book three was there used to be an epilogue. It's still available in the online version of that takes place in the present time, in which the current Darcy is called back to his family estate where he doesn't live. He lives in London, and he meets this photographer who. An investigator who's been sent by the Vatican to investigate this grave that they were, when they were doing restorations, they uncovered the grave of Saint Sebaldus, and they're like, wait, no, he's buried in Nuremberg. Why does this grave have that name on it? And they send this photographer and anthropologist or whatever named Liz. Darcy falls in love with her. There's some jokes where how between Darcy and his friend Charles, who's not meant to be Charles Bingley exactly, but the basic gist is there. When Charles is taking Adderall or Ritalin, I don't remember which one, and Darcy's taking Paxil because they're well medicated because they're living in modern times. But that just outright, source books didn't want it in, and I didn't fight it. I just said okay. But there was supposed to be a postscript to book three, which dealt with who's in the graveyard and why are there mysterious people in the graveyard who shouldn't be there. What else is going on? Not a lot, actually. This book was, I won't want to say this is an in-between book, but book three is major and book five is major. And book four was me recovering a lot from book three. Just book three was so huge, and I really wanted to do something more straightforward for book four. I threw in the Mary Bennet plot line because at some point I knew I had to marry her off. Not in an anti-feminist way, but just because it would sort of make her happy. She's so. Very self-sacrificing to the point of it being a little annoying. And I like that it was really her son who was the one who said, you should get married to this guy. You shouldn't hold yourself back just because you're a fallen woman, because clearly he doesn't care. So, you should get married. And she's the last of the Bennet sisters to be married. A lot of this is just, I didn't know that, at this point in the series, I kind of knew I was writing a series, but I wasn't really sure where it was going. And I didn't know that book five was going to be as major as it was. Book five is a lot of people's favorite book. It's my second favorite book after book eight. And book 10 probably is third. So a lot of stuff. I really hope that, we're waiting right now to hear from Ulysses Press as to whether they're going to buy book five, which is going to be based on sales of book four, not the content of book five. That's not the way publishers tend to work. It's usually based on sales of your previous book. If it's not published by them, it will be self-published, which will be a pain in the neck because I'll have to hire an editor and do all my own publicity, though really I do all my publicity by myself anyway nowadays. But that's why I'm recording this. But really, they do a lot of editing and they do a lot of stuff that I don't want to do myself and I don't want to pay someone to do. A lot of work goes into a book that people don't see. A lot of work and a lot of man hours and a lot of professionals are involved in each step of the book. So, doing that all by yourself is very intimidating, especially because it's not going to reach as many people if it's not in stores. And self-published books do not make it into stores, 99% of the time. They're not found in stores. So, either way, book five will be out, and I think people will really like it because it is pretty much the best book in the series. I hate to admit that because there's book six or ten come after it, and I don't want people to be let down, even though book six is a really weird book. I won't be upset if people don't like book six. But, book five is a major book, and I really can't wait for it to get published, though it'll probably be a year if Ulysses Press buys it, and at least 6 months if I have to self-publish it. So we'll see with book five. I don't really know yet what's up with that, but obviously once I know and can talk about it, because I generally don't talk about books when they're in contract stage, because I'm superstitious about it to some extent. I just rather not talk about it when we're doing legal things, and that can take like a month or two. So if you don't hear me talking about it at all, it's because I don't know anything or because it's in contract stage. Also, the Jewish holidays are coming up, so if you're listening to this currently and you are in September of 2011, Shana Tova and Good Yontif, Chag Sameach, all of the Jewish terms for the high holidays that are about to hit us, like a tsunami of way too many holidays all put together. So I won't be doing a lot of podcasts probably during this period because I have to be offline a lot for the holidays. And I only have one more to do, which is the one about other tales. Though if I blow like 15 minutes talking about other tales, you could have read other tales in that time period. And if people want to hear anything else about the series, about the co I know a lot about the general publishing industry and also the publishing industry of Pride and Prejudice type stuff and how those books come together and how they get bought and all of that. So if people want to know about that stuff, just leave comments and I'll talk about them in a future blog post. Otherwise, thanks for listening.